Chapter 18. Despite his many sources of revenue, daylight pyramiding kept him pinched for cash throughout the first winter. The paved gravel, thawed on bedrock and hoisted to the surface, immediately froze again. Thus his dumps, containing several millions of gold, were inaccessible. Not until the returning sun thawed the dumps, and melted the water, to wash them was he able to handle the gold they contained. And then he found himself with a surplus of gold, deposited in the two newly organized banks, and he was promptly besieged by men and groups of men, to enlist his capital in their enterprises. But he elected to play his own game, and he entered combinations, only when they were generally defensive or offensive. Thus, though he had paid the highest wages, he joined the Mine Owners Association, engineered the fight, and effectually curbed the growing insubordination of the wage earners. Times had changed. The old days were gone forever. This was a new era, and Daylight, the wealthy mine owner, was loyal to his class affiliations. It was true, the old-timers who worked for him, in order to be saved from the club of the organized owners, were made foremen over the gang of chechaquos. But this, with Daylight, was a matter of heart, not head. In his heart he could not forget the old days, while with his head he played the economic game according to the latest and most practical methods. But outside of such group combinations of exploiters, he refused to bind himself to any man's game. He was playing a great lone hand, and he needed all his money for his own backing. The newly founded stock exchange interested him keenly. He had never before seen such an institution, but he was quick to see its virtues, and to utilize it. Most of all, it was gambling, and on many an occasion not necessary for the advancement of his own schemes, he, as he called it, went the stock exchange a flutter, out of sheer wantonness and fun. "It sure beats Pharaoh," was his comment one day, when, after keeping the dozen speculators in a fever for a week by alternate bulling and bearing, he showed his hand and cleaned up what would have been a fortune to any other man. Other men, having made their strike, had headed south for the States, taking a furlough from the grim Arctic battle. But, asked when he was going outside, Daylight always laughed and said, when he had finished playing his hand. He also added, that a man was a fool, to quit a game, just when a winning hand had been dealt him. It was held by the thousands of hero-worshipping chechaquos that Daylight was a man absolutely without fear. But Bettles and Dan McDonald and other sourdoughs shook their heads, and laughed as they mentioned women. And they were right. He had always been afraid of them from the time, himself a lad of 17, when Queen Anne, of Juneau, made open and ridiculous love to him. For that matter, he never had known women. Born in a mining camp, where they were rare and mysterious, having no sisters, his mother dying while he was an infant, he had never been in contact with them. True, running away from Queen Anne, he had later encountered them on the Yukon, and cultivated an acquaintance with them, the pioneer ones who crossed the passes on the trail of the men who had opened up the first diggings. But no lamb had ever walked with a wolf in greater fear and trembling than had he walked with them. It was a matter of masculine pride that he should walk with them, and he had done so in fair seeming. But women had remained to him a closed book, and he preferred a game of solo or seven-up any time. And now, known as the King of the Klondike, carrying several other royal titles, such as El Dorado King, Bonanza King, the Lumber Baron, and the Prince of the Stampeders, not to omit the proudest appellation of all, namely, the Father of the Sourdoughs, he was more afraid of women than ever. As never before, they held out their arms to him, and more women were flocking into the country day by day. It mattered not whether he sat at dinner in the gold commissioner's house, called for the drinks in a dance hall, or submitted to an interview from the woman representative of the New York Sun, one and all of them held out their arms. There was one exception, and that was Frida, the girl that danced, and to whom he had given the flower. She was the only woman in whose company he felt at ease, for she alone never reached out her arms. And yet it was from her that he was destined to receive next to his severest fright. It came about in the fall of 1897. He was returning from one of his dashes, this time to inspect Henderson, a creek that entered the Yukon just below the Stewart. Winter had come on with a rush, and he fought his way down the Yukon 70 miles in a frail Peterborough canoe in the midst of a run of mush ice. Hugging the rim ice that had already solidly formed, he shot across the ice-spewing mouth of the Klondike just in time to see a lone man dancing excitedly on the rim, and pointing into the water. Next, he saw the fur-clad body of a woman, face under, sinking in the midst of the driving mush ice. A lane opening in the swirl of the current, it was a matter of seconds to drive the canoe to the spot, reach to the shoulder in the water, and draw the woman gingerly to the canoe's side. It was Frida. And all might yet have been well with him, had she not, later, when brought back to consciousness, blazed at him with angry blue eyes and demanded, "Why did you? Oh, why did you?" This worried him. In the nights that followed, instead of sinking immediately to sleep as was his wont, he lay awake, visioning her face and that blue blaze of wrath, and conning her words over and over. They rang with sincerity. The reproach was genuine. As he had meant just what she said. And still he pondered. The next time he encountered her, as he had turned away from him angrily and contemptuously. And yet again, she came to him to beg his pardon, and she dropped a hint of a man somewhere, sometime, she said not how, who had left her with no desire to live. Her speech was frank, but incoherent, and all he gleaned from it was that the event, whatever it was, had happened years before. Also, he gleaned that as he had loved the man. That was the thing, love. It caused the trouble. It was more terrible than frost or famine. Women were all very well, in themselves good to look upon and likable, but along came this thing called love, and they were seared to the bone by it, made so irrational, that one could never guess what they would do next. This Frida woman was a splendid creature, full-bodied, beautiful, and nobody's fool, but love had come along, and soured her on the world, driving her to the Klondike, and to suicide so compellingly, that she was made to hate the man that saved her life. Well, he had escaped love so far, just as he had escaped smallpox. Yet there it was, as contagious as smallpox, and a whole lot worse in running its course. It made men and women do such fearful and unreasonable things. It was like delirium tremens, only worse. And if he, Daylight, caught it, he might have it as badly as any of them. It was lunacy, stark lunacy, and contagious on top of it all. A half dozen young fellows were crazy over Frida. They all wanted to marry her. Yet she, in turn, was crazy over that some other fellow on the other side of the world, and would have nothing to do with him. But it was left to the Virgin to give him his final fright. She was found one morning dead in her cabin. A shot through the head had done it, and as he had left no message, no explanation. Then came the talk. Some wit, voicing public opinion, called it a case of too much daylight. As he had killed herself because of him. Everybody knew this, and said so. The correspondents wrote it up, and once more Burning Daylight, King of the Klondike, was sensationally featured in the Sunday supplements of the United States. The Virgin had straightened up, so the feature stories ran, and correctly so. Never had she entered a Dawson City dance hall. When she first arrived from Circle City, S. He had earned her living by washing clothes. Next, S. He had bought a sewing machine, and made men's drill parkas, fur caps, and moosehide mittens. Then S. He had gone as a clerk into the First Yukon Bank. All this, and more, was known and told, though one and all were agreed that Daylight, while the cause, had been the innocent cause of her untimely end. And the worst of it was that Daylight knew it was true. Always would he remember that last night he had seen her. He had thought nothing of it at the time, But, looking back, he was haunted by every little thing that had happened. In the light of the tragic event, he could understand everything, her quietness, that calm certitude, as if all vexing questions of living had been smoothed out and were gone, and that certain ethereal sweetness about all that S.E. had said and done that had been almost maternal. He remembered the way S.E. had looked at him, how she had laughed, when he narrated Mickey Dolan's mistake in staking the fraction on Skookum Gulch. Her laughter had been lightly joyous, while at the same time it had lacked its old-time robustness. Not that S.E. had been grave or subdued. On the contrary, S.E. had been so patently content, so filled with peace. S.E. had fooled him, fool that he was. He had even thought that night that her feeling for him had passed, and he had taken delight in the thought, and caught visions of the satisfying future friendship that would be theirs with this perturbing love out of the way. And then, when he stood at the door, cap in hand, and said good night, it had struck him at the time as a funny and embarrassing thing, her bending over his hand and kissing it. He had felt like a fool, but he shivered now, when he looked back on it, and felt again the touch of her lips on his hand. She was saying goodbye, an eternal goodbye, and he had never guessed. At that very moment, and for all the moments of the evening, coolly and deliberately, as he well knew her way, as he had been resolved to die. If he had only known it. Untouched by the contagious malady himself, nevertheless he would have married her, if he had had the slightest inkling of what she contemplated. And yet he knew, furthermore, that hers was a certain stiff-kneed pride that would not have permitted her to accept marriage as an act of philanthropy. There had really been no saving her, after all. The love disease had fastened upon her, and as he had been doomed from the first to perish of it. Her one possible chance had been that he too should have caught it, and he had failed to catch it. Most likely, if he had, it would have been from Frieda or some other woman. There was Dartworthy, the college man who had staked the rich fraction on Bonanza above Discovery. Everybody knew that old Doolittle's daughter, Bertha, was madly in love with him. Yet, when he contracted the disease, of all women, it had been with the wife of Colonel Wolfstone, the great Guggenheimer mining expert. Result, 3 lunacy cases. Dartworthy selling out his mine for 1/10 its value, the poor woman sacrificing her respectability and sheltered nook in society to flee with him in an open boat down the Yukon, and Colonel Wolfstone, breathing murder and destruction, taking out after them in another open boat. The whole impending tragedy had moved on down the muddy Yukon, passing 40-mile land circle and losing itself in the wilderness beyond. But there it was, love, disorganizing men's and women's lives, driving toward destruction and death, turning topsy-turvy everything that was sensible and considerate, making bawds or suicides out of virtuous women, and scoundrels and murderers out of men who had always been clean and square. For the first time in his life, Daylight lost his nerve. He was badly and avowedly frightened. Women were terrible creatures, and the love germ was especially plentiful in their neighborhood. And they were so reckless, so devoid of fear. They were not frightened by what had happened to the Virgin. They held out their arms to him more seductively than ever. Even without his fortune, reckoned as a mere man, just past 30, magnificently strong and equally good-looking and good-natured, he was a prize for most normal women. But when to his natural excellences were added the romance that linked with his name and the enormous wealth that was his, practically every free woman he encountered measured him with an appraising and delighted eye, to say nothing of more than one woman who was not free. Other men might have been spoiled by this and led to lose their heads, but the only effect on him was to increase his fright. As a result, he refused most invitations to houses where women might be met, and frequented bachelor boards and the Moosehorn Saloon, which had no dance hall attached. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.